Welcome back to the Aware Show. Hi, this is Lisa Gar. We're having fun this afternoon. As always, one of my favorite hobbies is finding out why people do the things they do. I love finding out why myself and other people, I mean, what makes them tick. When I was younger, when you were able to go hang out at airports, and I used to just watch people come and go, and I would make up my own little stories and watch behaviors, and it's just one of my hobbies that I did. You know, that was a while ago because now you can't do that anymore. That was one of my favorite dates. But anyway, so what I've done is I've kind of become my own little personality profiler. But my guest today, Samuel Barondis, is a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist, and he's written a book, among many others, called Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personality. So in layman terms, why your mom did what she did, why your dad, your boss, your partner, your sister, your brother, people in your life, your relationships, what they do and why they do it. And why is this important, ultimately? It's basically to help you get along better with these people in your life. Welcome to the show, Samuel. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Lisa.
So tell me, what inspired you to write this book? What made you put all of this together? Because we're going to get into the whole five broad types of personalities and so forth in a second. But what made you write it?
Sure. Well, my initial impetus was just like yours. I, too, like most of us, am very curious about people and what makes them tick. And I've been that way since I was a kid, and it wound me up in psychiatry, which is a field which gives you ways of thinking about that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I became increasingly interested and finally put down what I'd learned in this book.
Well, okay, let's talk a little bit about the whole system. And I actually went on your website and I started to take the test, but it was a little bit late. So I need to go back into taking the test, and we'll talk about it in a second. But
okay,
what are the five broad areas, the big five areas of personality traits that you write about in the book?
Yes, I will explain them, but I also want to make clear from the start that that's not the whole story, and if we have time, we should get to the other parts of the story. But let's start with these five basic dispositional traits, which we all have and which we all express to a greater or lesser extent. So that the whole idea of these five traits, which psychologists have figured out over the years, is that they're fundamental building blocks of personality. We all have them in some form. We all express them in some form. And the idea is to sort out, when you start thinking about a person, where they are in each of these five traits. But that's just the start of figuring them out. Okay, so with that little preamble, I can go through the five traits, okay?
Okay, all right, great.
Okay, so the first is called extroversion or introversion. That is to say, it's about how outgoing and sociable a person is. And by the way, all these five things are things that we intuitively, instinctively notice about a person the moment we meet them. But we don't really think about it. We do it all intuitively because we don't have time to think about it.
We just assimilate it.
We have this incredible brain that kind of sorts it out. And we do it fast or down and dirty, but we don't do it in a way which we can go back and uncode unless we know how to do it. So the purpose of knowing about these five things, which we know about intuitively, is to pay attention to them consciously, because then they can become more meaningful for us as building blocks.
Okay, so then we need to figure out, of course, what we do when we figure out these.
Indeed. So there's a lot to talk about, but let's get started with the fundamentals, which you asked me about, these big five. So the first one is extroversion, which is the dimension. So we figure out when we meet a person how sociable, how dominant, how outgoing, how assertive they are. All those qualities are lumped together into this thing called extroversion. The second one is a measure of how good-natured the person is. Do they like people, or are they kind of distrustful and suspicious? And that second one is called agreeableness. So we have extroversion and agreeableness.
Okay.
The third one, should I go through all of them,
The trustworthiness. Okay. Is that where trustworthiness comes in?
Trustworthiness is part of agreeableness.
Agreeableness,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. People who are trusting are highly agreeable. people who are suspicious and paranoid tend to be disagreeable. They see the cup half empty. They see people as being kind of bad or dangerous. The highly agreeable people see people as good-natured, people that want to be their friends, people that will be helpful. So it's a completely different view of the world, and lots of us are somewhere in between. You can be extremely one, or you can be extremely the other, or you can be somewhere in between, and that's a really important concept too.
So neither of them are good or bad, right? There's no judgment on these.
None of them are intrinsically good or bad, although being at the extremes is more likely to cause problems, which we can get to. For example, if you're too unbelievably agreeable, people might take advantage of you because you're nice to everybody. You
right.
have no shred of suspiciousness in you. On the other hand, if you're at the other end of the spectrum of agreeableness and are too suspicious and distrusting and see everybody as bad, mm-hmm. people find you frosty and disagreeable, and they don't want to have anything to do with you either. So it's not great to be at the extremes.
Okay.
But intrinsically, they don't have to be bad. It depends on the whole package, and the whole package is one that has other pieces to it, too. So, okay, that's number two. So we've got extroversion and agreeableness. The next one is conscientiousness, and that has to do with how competent, how well-organized, how reliable, how hard-working a person is. So people who come to work on time, who really are very concerned about being organized and getting things done in an efficient way, rank high on conscientiousness. People who are kind of lazy and very laid back and unreliable and don't show up on time are very low on conscientiousness. So that's conscientiousness. Okay?
Okay, all right.
So we've got three. We've got extroversion, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. I'll give you at the end a way to remember them.
Okay.
The fourth one is called neuroticism. Neuroticism has to do with emotional stability. How emotionally stable is the person? Are they calm, relaxed, cool, tranquil? Or on the other extreme, mm-hmm. are they nervous, tense, prone to get angry? Do they view the world with dark glasses as being gloomy? Those are the people who are high in neuroticism. So the dimension of neuroticism or emotional stability. And finally, to round it out, what we call openness to experience. How open is the person to new ideas? How open are they to new experiences? Or conversely, how rigidly conservative are they? How much are they sticks in the mud who don't want to do anything new and don't trust anything new?
Okay.
So those are the five.
Okay. A real easy way to remember all five?
The way to remember all five, there were two mnemonics for all five. The one that most people like is called OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N, O for openness, C for conscientiousness, E for extroversion, mm-hmm. A for agreeableness, and N for neuroticism. So that's the one the readers can take, or the listeners can take away if they like.
Okay.
It's a little hard to remember. You get the ideas, but you don't remember what the words are because they're not necessarily the best words for these qualities.
So OCEAN,
openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism.
And now let's talk about how this would apply to people that you meet or that you know or that you love or that your family members and you work with, et cetera. How does this apply?
Yeah, okay, right, okay. Well, there's lots to say, but let's just stick with the basics. Okay, so when you meet somebody, if you stop and think about it, you will have noticed that you probably have paid attention to some of these things. You've probably taken a little measure of all of them, but some of them may stick out so you notice them more in the particular person, and some of them may stick out because you're more interested in those things. You happen to be a person who's more interested in one or the other of these traits. But when you want to try to assess somebody, it's useful to stand back and think of what you may have left out. So, for example, you may meet somebody and notice immediately how outgoing they are and maybe also how agreeable they are. But, you know, in being charmed by their apparent agreeableness and their outgoingness, you may pay very little attention to how conscientious, neurotic, and open they are. And those things actually may be very important in the kind of relationship you may have with them, but you may be blinded by those more obvious traits and less conscious of and aware of others, which over a longer period of time may turn out to be very important in your relationship with them.
Because they amplify?
Well, no, because they also are important, but you just aren't noticing them. For example, it's so easy to be charmed by somebody who's not conscientious, you know, who is not reliable, because they may have other positive qualities that you find attractive. But when push comes to shove, you suddenly find that they're missing in action, that they're not on time, that they're not that they promise you things and they don't deliver, et cetera, et cetera. So this is stuff that you will notice in the course of your life. It's not that these five things are things that are mysteries that scientists have discovered in some deep, dark cave.
Right, right.
All this stuff is right out there. We all see it, but we don't pay attention to it frequently because we don't have a system for thinking about it.
So if we notice that our partner is extroverted or that we love that and that they're agreeable and that they're open to new experiences, but they're not conscientious about where they leave things around the house and they're not on time when you want them to be home and
yeah.
so forth. That is that a typical situation that you would explain?
You can see that, and that's not
right.
necessarily bad. You know, you pays your money and you takes your choice. You can pay it. You can note it. Actually, one of the reasons it's worth noting and noting consciously is that sometimes you find, yeah, this guy looks so great or this girl looks so great, but there's something about them that I don't like, and it really makes me mad. But you don't really know what it is. It's that you're responding to this thing about they're not on time and they leave stuff lying around and they're not very conscientious. If you have a way of just thinking it through and then assessing it, you might say, oh, okay, that's what's really bothering me. And then you can decide how important that is. You may decide, well, the package is great. I will live with that.
Right.
And I'm not going to get so upset about it anymore because now I know what it is that's bothering me. So that's one way of applying it.
So let's use somebody that is a well-known character such as Bill Clinton. You had mentioned that in your book.
Yes, so, Bill Clinton.
All right. So now we explain how you would use this system when you're looking at someone like that and then how you would look at them differently, being aware of these five different types of dimensions.
Well, I think that one of the reasons I use Bill Clinton amongst other people like Barack Obama or lots of other famous people in the course of my book is that they are people that we have seen a lot. So,
mm-hmm.
and that you and I have seen a lot. So rather than talk about some person that I met and then try to describe them, you won't remember that because you don't have any grounding in it.
Right.
Whereas you've seen Bill Clinton hundreds of times. So you have some measure of Bill Clinton and you have some ideas in your mind about Bill Clinton, and the reader might for a moment just think, what do you think about Bill Clinton? Just spend a moment, like what comes into your mind? Okay, and then let's see what we can find out by going through these five factors.
This
is not the whole story of Bill Clinton, of course. This is just one little piece, and I cover lots of other things in my book, but let's just stick with this. Okay, extroversion. Bill Clinton is a poster boy for extroversion. He is like Mr. Extroversion. He loves to be the center of attraction. He's very assertive. He's very outgoing. He's very, very friendly. He loves to be with people. He's highly sociable. So he is Mr. Extroversion, a very attractive quality that many of us find very attractive, although some people like introverts. Some people like quiet, shy people. Some people are quiet and shy, and you can be perfectly happy in your life being quiet and shy. But Mr. Clinton happens to be, like, out there as Mr. Extroversion. Okay, so you notice that. This is something you intuitively notice. Now, agreeableness. Bill Clinton seems, on the face of it, really agreeable. You know, he's a hail fellow, well met. People who meet him say, wow, I talk to him, and, you know, in his presence, I feel like he loves me, like, and he makes me feel like the most important person in the world.
He's very charismatic. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but one finds out, however, if one gets to know Mr. Clinton better, that he's a great user, that, you know, like a lot of politicians, and that, you know, he has honed that way of approaching you, but if you get to know him better, you find out that actually his agreeableness is not nearly as high as it appears. So that's a notable thing, that on the face of it, agreeableness looks terrific, but as you get to know him better, you find out that he is not quite quite that high there. He does things, he takes advantage of people, he's deceptive. You know, he does a lot of things which pull his ranking on agreeableness down once you think about it, okay?
These are things he probably doesn't know much about, know even about himself, but...
Well, you know, he's actually a pretty shrewd guy. I don't know what he knows about himself, but be that as it may. Well, none of us really know a lot about ourselves. And apropos of this, the thing that I find most important in using this system is to apply it to others rather than oneself. One learns to apply it to oneself, too, but we tend to be better at doing it with others because we can be a little bit more objective about others than we tend to be about ourselves. But, you know, that's a whole other story. Anyway, proceeding with Mr. Clinton, conscientiousness. He has some aspects of conscientiousness that are quite high. He's a hardworking guy. He's, you know, but he also is... He can be a bit unreliable. He can be a bit of a slacker, and he's got some very strong traits of conscientiousness. But overall picture medium. That's my take on him. Neuroticism. He is not very high in neuroticism, but he gets very angry. If you cross Bill Clinton, he can really throw temper tantrums, etc. So score that I give him based on what I know about him, and of course it's all based on his public actions and what one reads in his autobiography, is medium in neuroticism and openness. He's quite open. He's a guy who thinks big ideas. He's interested in new things. He's adventurous. So his profile is extreme extroversion, less agreeableness than you might think, pretty high conscientiousness, medium to low neuroticism, and high openness. That's my take on him based on seeing him on television lots of times.
So,
knowing people who know him and reading his autobiography.
So what do you do with that type of information when you find that out about someone? You just assimilate it with the interactions and the trustworthiness,
yes,
of what it is that they're saying?
Yes, but you see, it's not the whole story, and this is why. So let me switch to another part of the story, which I think you also have to take into consideration along with these dispositional traits. And that's the other end of the spectrum. There are a bunch of things that I discuss in my book that one looks for. These five factors, these dispositional traits, these basic traits, are a starting point, and a starting point because we notice it immediately, or we get data on it immediately. But the other end is also really important, and that is what I call identity. What does the person think about themselves? How do they tell themselves their life is organized? Where do they think they came from? Who do they think they are now? And where do they think they're headed? That whole concept is quite different from these dispositional traits, and every bit is important in making sense of a person. And that whole self-concept is one that we develop largely in our teens and young adulthood, and it's what psychologists and psychiatrists call identity, and it too is essential in understanding somebody. So the big five tell you about their dispositional traits. Are they outgoing or shy? Are they agreeable or suspicious? Stuff like that. The identity tells you about who they think they are and where they're headed. And that can frequently be much more important in your relationship,
yes,
than all those other things. Because if you share with or identify with a person's vision of themselves and their future, that may make for an excellent relationship. And if you figure out where they're going, you see, and again, this is something that we don't do very well intuitively, that we don't really pay much attention to, that we don't think about. But then people tell us lots about if we want to pay attention to it. You know, where are you headed? What do you do? Where are you going? But this concept that the person carries around in their head about what they stand for is extraordinarily important in making sense of who they are.
Well, I could see this would make a lot of sense for someone who's maybe thinking about getting into a relationship with two people that are from different cultural backgrounds. And whereas
yes,
that's important to the family. So if you come from a specific tradition and you really want, you find a partner that's not from that same tradition, if you go through these different types of profiles and really find out what your identity is and how you're attached to that or not, it could really help people that are in love get through and understand those different types of cultural differences.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, the reality is that people from different cultures frequently have very similar identities. They're just decorated with little cultural traditions which distinguish them. But in reality, they have a great commonality of life purpose, which might make them extraordinarily compatible. But there is the issue of culture as well, and culture is not something that can be dismissed out of hand. And in a society like the one we live in, which is so heterogeneous, these cultural factors obviously also play a part in making sense of a person. And if I can just segue there, there's also the issue of a moral assessment of a person, which is another piece of the system that I describe in my book, which is different from the two that I've just discussed. And it gets around that idea called character. And now moral judgments are based on two characteristics. One are innate tendencies to decide on what's fair and proper. We all inherit in our genes, to various extents, a moral sense. We all know that it's not fair to cut in front of somebody on a line. And if somebody does it, we get really upset. You know, just, we have this, you know, we just don't like that. That's like unfair. We have lots of ideas about fairness. Little kids, when they're 3 years old, know that if Johnny got more of the pie than Jane, that's not fair. And they know it with ferocity. So part of our moral evaluation of people is intuitive. But then superimposed on it is a cultural morality, and that varies from culture to culture. For example, in America, we have a sense of morality which emphasizes individual autonomy and individual rights. But there are cultures, like the Hindu culture in India, which emphasizes what they call the ethics of community and the ethics of divinity. They're more interested
family.
Family, mm-hmm. And also family, tribe, mm-hmm. culture, and God. So they are they consider themselves in that culture representative of their family, for example. So they care, if they dishonor their family, it's a terrible thing.
Right.
But in America, in lots of America, America is obviously very heterogeneous, but the dominant culture in America is individualistic. So there's a very, very different cultural assessment of these ways of doing things.
I can see how this would definitely work, especially even in a work situation where your
Absolutely.
Coworkers are very talented in what they do, but you don't get along with their personalities. And we just have a minute left, so I wanted to sum this up for people so that they could dig into this deeper. This is, for the way that I'm seeing this, is when you decode these personalities, it will help you get along with situations that you are sometimes either in a family situation or a work situation or even a relationship situation with families. You can understand people better and allow you to accept or not accept them. But it definitely puts it into a way that's a lot more palatable for people rather than just getting agitated and in resistance to the relationships that are in your life. Is that basically what you're saying, is the whole point?
That's great. That's great, Lisa, but I want to come back to what you started with at the beginning, which was the business about sitting and watching people.
Yeah.
One of the good things about this system, once you learn it, is that you become much better at just understanding everybody, understanding characters in the movies, understanding everybody that you deal with. And understanding makes you appreciate things better. If you go to a baseball game and you just watch them hitting the ball and you don't know what the rules are and you don't know how it works, you don't get much fun out of the baseball game. But if you've got a system in your head,
right,
a conscious system that says this is how it works and this is what a batting average is and this is what's good and this is what the left-handed pitcher does, etc., your appreciation is hugely increased.
So understanding helps you appreciate people
better. Appreciate everybody.
And I appreciate you. Thank you so much, Samuel Barondis. And the name of the book is called Making Sense of People. Thank you so much for...
Thank you, Lisa.
...helping us understand this afternoon.
My pleasure.
All right. This is Lisa Gar. You've been listening to The Aware Show. And until next time, I invite you all to stay aware.